tape was made at Matt Spielman's house on December 5th, 1977. The two people who are talking through it are Matt Spielman, whose full name is Will Matt Spielman, and William Falwell, F-O-L-W-E-L-L, Jester, who told us he was 74 years old. He is the first voice that you hear on the tape, and the one that you hear mostly in the tape. Karen Kroner from the National Seashore was also there, and I was taping Mary Keelan at the same time.
I think there's a nurse, DeBlonde, that's doing the same shoot. And we killed 16 wild geese, and Dr. Joe Gaten and myself. That day he sent my picture.
Yes, and this was in the 30s, you think? Yes. Now, where was this? Where were you hunting at that time? Was that right
up
around
in Maryland, no. Up in Maryland, no.
I saw that thing, right?
From the Maryland, Virginia line, about 3 miles.
Yeah.
They had a lot of, they had about 2,500 acres of marshland.
Oh,
and we shot on it all together.
Bill was showing old pictures of the tape and ducks for one day, that time in the 30s.
Smith brother, you know, L. C. Smith, he made the Escogun and the L. C. Smith shotgun and the typewriter. Well, that was one of his party. That wasn't him, but that's one of his party.
I see. And you took this party out, Bill? Is that what?
The way it was, he just was a club that had the membership, and each I remember took his dates, and he brought his friends with him. It was more of a business proposition. Some of the great big deals were done there. The Chesapeake was pretty well settled right there in that club, Matt. Because I was coming down one day, and he long and stopped by Major Allen when they were hit a jet. He ran a company. He wore it when it showed. He had the State Road Commissioner of the State of Maryland with him. And I knew something was brewing. And he did after that.
Hey, Richard,
just
your number. That's the thing up there to the Maryland line. He's lived there.
We will put a card with a cape tape too, but I want it right on the tape. Nat, you are Nathan.
No.
No.
Just Nat. But first is Will. W-I-L-L.
I see. Will. All right, Will.
And then N-A-T.
And then N-A-T, right?
I'm glad you gave it that because it's going to put a nickname on it very well. Sure. Steelman. S-T-E-L-L-M-A-N.
Right, and this is December 5th, isn't it? 1977 that we're talking. And now I would love to have your full name, Bill. Bill said that his full name was William Falwell Jester, F-O-L-W-E-L-L, Jester, and that his family had always lived on Chincoteague.
Father before me.
Yes.
And my great-grandfather, as far back as we know.
Yes.
I don't know where I came from, but he must have been from England because Jester is an English name.
Right.
And, he lived located on the upper end of Chincoteague Island on the northeast end. And he owned, I guess he owned for near 30 island, I would say, wouldn't he, that?
Yeah.
And he was one of the first ones who began to get these Assateague ponies and raise them. He had ponies high. When I was a boy, I can remember going up there and I could see these ponies. And actually, I would see what I wanted, but I never would get it to me because I realized now I was too young. And he accumulated at his time quite a bit of money. He would write well, what we would say, write well, but.
Right.
And there was another thing about him, I've always heard people say that he was a man of his word, that his word was his bond. And he used to own all this land up there. Well, around the shore, they had a lot of natural growth oysters. In those days, the oysters grew big, and he had one of his daughters married Captain John Bunting down here. W.C. Bunting is the son of Captain John Bunting, who was my great-grandfather's daughter, married his daughter. He would sail, he had a sailboat, Captain John did, and he'd sail a schooner to New York and carry the oysters while my grandfather, my great-grandfather, he got the oysters together up here around the head of the island. And in those days, they got $5 bushel for oysters.
Yeah.
That's been a long time ago. My father said to me once, the first money he ever made, he went out and washed the bay, and he caught a bushel of oysters. He was nothing but a small boy. His father died when he was real young, and he said he got $1 for that bushel of oysters. They were nice big oysters. They were fat, and he got $1 for it.
And they were all natural oysters.
All natural growth oysters.
Huh. And this was in the present Oyster Bay. In this
That's right, Oyster Bay and Chincoteague Bay, around the whole end of the upper end of the island. So that's the way he made his living and accumulated his money. Of course, he would go down to what we call going down the bay. That was taking a boat and going down around maybe Watch a Prig and off in that vicinity around them islands and places, and they would catch tarpon. In those days, tarpon was on a big price, too.
Mm.
And he would do that certain times of year. I heard my father say he went with him when he was a boy because he raised my father and my father's brother. And he used to take his boys with him. He said one time they were down there in a storm, and his hat blew off. He would keep two boys in the cabin of the boat, and he was out over the wheel trying to manage the boat the best he could. And he said he would pray. He would see, they'd pray. And one time his hat blew off, and he grabbed him the towel that they had to wipe their faces with, and he put that around his head. And after a while, they weathered the storm, and they got back home safe. But that was their life. They were watermen. And then after years, my father grew up, and he moved up to Green Run. His mother married again. And there he began to shoot with a gun. He used to kill the fowl for the Green Run Hotel table.
Green Run is where is Green Run? Green Run is about 15 miles above Shakespeare, right up on the ocean. Oh, Jimmy Scott's Hotel. Yeah, on Astoria, once was a hotel. Fowl farm for Mr. Jim Scott. That's where he met my mother. She had born and raised in North Beach. But when she was a girl, her father moved down here, what we call Raggy Point.
Now you see that on the map.
Yes, yes.
Well, that's why they lived until her and my father were married, and then they, a little place above that, they called Great Neck. It was a point of land that went out toward Chesapeake Bay. And they had a little home there, and that's where they lived. Until after a while, when the railroads come and the boat came to Chesapeake, they could ship their stuff to New York and different places. Then those people moved closer by the railroads. And then him and my mother, after they lived there for quite a while, they moved back to Chesapeake here. And then he began to go into the oyster business certain times a year, and then he would shoot fowl in the winter time for a living. But they didn't shoot fowl like these fellows do out here now. They didn't go out and try to kill them all one day.
Mm-hmm.
He would lay around for 2 or 3 weeks or a month, and he watched these flocks of redheads get them used to a certain place. And then he would go there with the right kind of wind, and he would shoot them. And he would kill enough maybe for the last for a month or two, make that much money, because in those days they got high as $3.50 a fire for their redheads when they shipped them into New York. So that's the way he made his living, and we children were raised right up into it. We had ponies, we've always had ponies up until I married and moved away from home. And many a time we've sat to the dinner table and the pony would reach his head over and we'd give him a biscuit from off the table. We all grew up together, the ponies, and we did. My father had about 9 ponies. And we boys rode them all around everywhere, and you'll see these pictures, some of them, where we used to keep them around the folks on Duck Club. And we would ride them. We could weigh them off of that island over on the ocean beach, and on that fatigue, and then we would ride all over the beaches anywhere I want to. Sometimes we'd get froze up there when I was working for the club. And we'd take these ponies and bring the guests down here to Assateague, and then bring them across the Chincoteague in the boat, and they'd go home from here. Where when it was froze over, say we should get them in boats, and we couldn't go across the bay when it was froze over, and the boats would be running down the beach. And these ponies, we used them, one to a carriage, the other to a road cart. We had an old ox we called Old Mike, and he carried the luggage in the steer cart, and that's the way they came down from Hope's on Duck Club in the wintertime, during the ducking season, when the bay was frozen over.
For instance, how did things like oxen get here? Everything had to come by boat. Is that right originally? Did people bring these things in their own boats? Was there a main boat that came between the mainland here, or did you have your own boats to transport your things?
Well, in the beginning, they had to have their own boats. But later, then more people began to accumulate. Then the different ones saw where it would be a profit into having a boat that would sail back and forth at different times.
Yeah, but that was later.
Yeah,
initially,
they used to have to market their own stuff.
I see. Where did you go for now? You were saying that you would get a month's supply. Was that month's supply of birds for you and your family?
No, what I meant by that, he would ship them into New York.
And how did he do that?
Get money enough to keep his family for 2 or 3 months on that one day's kill.
Right. So how did he do that? For instance, where did he go to ship those birds?
Well, he would kill them up here around the head of the island, and there was shallow water up above 60 on the called Gilroy Shoals. And it was a place where a lot of this eelgrass grew, and it was great feeding grounds for
right,
ducks.
Right, right, and the branch.
Of course, the redhead run more. Now, my father wasn't hard to shoot a black mallard duck because they only got $1 a pair for them, and they didn't want to waste the ammunition to kill them. But the redhead duck is what I am. They were the ones that they would shoot because they didn't take too much ammunition. They come in great flocks and kill a lot of herds. They one time killed 22 out of one flock.
The redhead, the distinct redhead duck, this is not canvasback.
No, distinct redhead duck.
And you had more redheads here than canvasback, or was it just that they were preferable?
In them days, we did. No, we never did have very many canvasbacks here because we never had the right feeding bottom.
Mm-hmm.
They were more of a brackish water duck, and there weren't any canvasback.
Right.
We did have redhead and what they call a blackhead.
Mm-hmm. You know, in New York, is it mostly the breast meat or the feathers that people were interested in of the ducks?
They were just interested in the meat.
Huh. It didn't spoil, I guess.
I'm at the restaurants and the hotels, and then people would give them big dinners and eat some of the first
Oh, yes,
stuff.
It'd be quite a dollar.
That's right, yeah.
Would you be corn fed?
No.
Tastes better.
Yeah, they would be, but in them days, they never corn fed those red-headed ducks. I'll tell you about this sweet eelgrass we had. It was one of the most wonderful things we have ever had. The duck ate the root of it. And the root of the eelgrass, if you dug down in the bottom, would bend something like you see your wiregrass root, a little lots of long straight. And if you took that and take in your mouth and chewed it, it was sweet.
Wow.
And the wild beast in shallow bottom would go and dig it out, and dig holes in the bottom and get the root of it. Yeah, the roots of it. And then naturally they'd cut the top of it off, or sometimes it would have a spear on it.
To Maryland. What was your...
Well, we would go to Chincoteague right here, Chincoteague right on up the bay. Up
here,
we didn't go on Assateague Beach at all when we were working with the flood because it was an island off to the northwest of Assateague Beach.
I see.
But we could lead from this island over to the Assateague Beach because the water was shallow.
With the mainland. Did you go from there right to the mainland? Or did you come through
Chicago? They moved from there down here to Chincoteague.
No,
for supplies, for instance,
We didn't get none of supplies. The way they supplied themselves mostly was they'd get a barrel of flour in the summertime, and they would have their own hogs. And they'd get some molasses, and that's practically all they needed. They'd kill all the raw fowl they wanted to eat. They had
grow
no hogs, you only had to do turn them loose, kind of booting one. And if they wanted beef, they had cattle the same way that ran loose on these beef. Hogs and cattle both.
Yes.
And that's the way they lived. They didn't have to come to town once, twice a year to get what they wanted.
How long would $100 last?
Oh, my Lord, $100 lasted a year. Jim Merton and them fellas were sailing out of Greenland Inlet for $5 a month on these schooners. Yeah. They were in Oxford, New York, that's what they
$5 a month.
$5 a month.
Flour. $5 a month.
Oh, did they grow good vegetables on that soil there?
Yeah, they would grow a little garden. You can go up there now and see places where they laid banks around their garden so that the salt water wouldn't come in. I can tell you awful talks I've seen down there where they had their own gardens, and they raised different kinds of stuff, corn and different things. And then there was a lot of things they could pick up on the beach. Like there was a, what was that, Matt? It was a sea cabbage that grew. What was that stuff called? They got together just like you would see down the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Green. It was some kind of a bush that grew up, and they looked like they would a trunk ring.
Now, is that the present farm fields area at all? Was that farm at that time? You know what we call the old fields and the farm fields?
I don't think Old Field was ever farm, because it always, far back as I can remember, well, those low places like. Of course, they filled each end of it up and the tide took in, but it used not to be still pretty well dry. But if you've been around the old Ragged Point house, they had a place fenced in out there, I guess to an acre or two, that they had a garden.
Mm-hmm.
And they had ponies around. They'd take these beach ponies, get them a small farm, they'd tie the land up with them,
yes,
cultivate it, and they would go their truck. Actually, they'd done most of it by hand and a hoe. They,
yeah,
they hoed the corn and stuff like that. They didn't work like they did nowadays. Actually, with everything way back there, and they didn't have such a modern thing.
How many people would you think were living on Assateague when you lived there, for instance? How many families would you think?
Well, up that way, I would say there was family Ragged Point. There was about four families in what we call Great Neck, and there was there were two folks' islands. There was a family lived on each one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the way up between here and Green Run, there would be people living long in different places. Sometimes they'd be a mile apart, and sometimes 2 miles apart, and sometimes
right. They'd
be one or two together, just scattered around all over.
Yes, right.
Because these people, the way they made their living is with natural growth orchards.
Mm-hmm.
In the summertime, they would go out in the bay, and orchards grew all over the bay those days. The water went like this, and I didn't have so many screwdrivers. And the people would go out and hone them. And if he got himself 35 or 40 bushel of oysters in the summer, and that schooner came into Green Run Inlet, and he loaded his oysters in New York, he'd get $1 bushel, he had 35. Well, that's all they're going to eat money for the winter.
That's terrific.
Well, that's all they do. And then they would fish a little bit down in the summer. They would put in fish, and they would fish around. And then they would salt the fish for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have fish all the winter. They'd be salted, but that's what they would eat.
You live so different. You didn't need much. $100 an acre.
something like that. Anyway, the fellow bought it, and he said, "Something, what was it?" He said, and they said, "No, that's not it. That's greenbacks." He got the name of greenbacks, right?
Interesting.
Yeah, that book, if you could get it, would be very interesting.
Yeah, I would love to read it.
It would give you some of the history of Shaker the Yarn.
Right,
and it would give you some of the history of acetate.
Yeah.
Now, in there, I don't know your garden stuff or not, anyway.
Yes, I'm recording it down.
There was a man and his family lived on Assateague Island during the Revolutionary War. And he disappeared. He was out clamming one day. I hear around these golden things. See, in those days, there were two of them, Shaker-Tigger and Assateague. Well, this man was out here clamming, and he disappeared. And so his wife and his children gave him up. Well, they were there, but there were not many families around. No way to make a livelihood, so they decided they would move to Green Run. They were going in those days. They took what little furniture and stuff they had and put it in a pole boat. And they pulled from here to Green Run, about 15 miles. And they had given the man up, and they started to go to Green Run. Well, around there, it would work for the women down in hotels and things, and they had better advantage to make a living. So they started up, and they began pulling. Well, they got up here. When you get up here above Assateague Wood, then over there, our ocean beach is right flat, nothing but a sandy beach, just like a desert from the ocean to the bay.
Is that what they call the big levels now?
I imagine so, just above Assateague Wood, was what we call a level, that's right. And when they were pulling long enough, they looked and seen a man walking across toward the bay from the ocean. And so they looked and they recognized that it was this woman's husband, Joe's father. And when they got to him, he came and then, of course, naturally went back home. And he told him he'd been captured. This British man of war came in here. And they seen this man clamming, and they rowed ashore in his boat, and actually he didn't run from him or anything, and they took him and carried him for this man of war and kept him all of this time. Until they had given him up for dead, and then they came up here one day, well, they set him ashore back on the beach. He was walking home. That folks they come missing him, if they'd have missed him, he'd had gone.
Well,
he found him, I guess, after a while, but they'd moved on to him.
Do you remember any of the names of any of the people who lived on Assateague when you did? Do you remember any of the family names?
Well, they were mostly Joneses.
Mm-hmm. Is that the Mr. Jones who's down at the hardware now? Is he down showers?
Norman Jones was, so he just got a while back, and Bill Jones, those are the descendants of these people that lived over there, but I don't think there's very many, unless some of his children is living now, came over there. They were Elliots lived over there, and Joneses, and a different one, the Murrays. I think the Murrays lived over there one time. You know, they had a case of smallpox, man, and not the Murray family died over there. That's where it was.
Well, we're still living.
I guess he is.
He's got scars on him from that small talk to you, I think.
Yeah. Jim Henry had a lot on him.
In
those days, they didn't have much medication for that kind of disease. I guess it was terrible. Most people died. So some over it, but those that did over it, well, I left them with a scar on them.
There were Joneses that lived at the Tom's Cove area.
Yeah. It was about, let's see, there was Bill Jones, Frank Jones, and who was the other?
See, Lonzie?
Herman
lived there.
Yeah, they were descendants of Bill
Jones. Norman.
They were three.
Roland.
Yeah, they're all descendants of these Joneses.
Ernest.
Lonnie Jones is around.
The first one died back as I remember was Bill Jones. That was old man Bill Jones. He was the father of our great-grandfather Bill Jones over here in York State.
Yeah.
And then Norman Jones was Frank Jones' son. That's really something from him. But there was another Jones there.
Well, his wife's his daughter.
Yeah, all of them. Mostly Joneses over there. Yeah.
What did you do to build houses? For instance, did the wood... Now, all these houses on Shaker-Tigger really were done with a sort of narrow thing. Was this wood from Shaker-Tigger and Assateague that they used? This was not from the mainland, or was it?
No, they used their party wood.
Mm-hmm.
There used to be a sawmill here on the island years ago.
Yeah, he drove us in way back there. This was a lumber yard right where this house is.
Wow. Yeah. And the lumber was from here.
They had places over there that had salt pits where they went in the land and they'd dig out and then they would make the salt.
Is this Shaker-Tigger or Assateague?
That was over on Assateague, just below Ragged Point and those levels that you're thinking about in the upper end of them. You see, this water would come in and dry up and form. After all, that was nothing but a crust of salt. And they'd go there and they'd get that out, dig down till the water would spring through it. And then they would put it through some kind of a process, of like a distillery or something, and distill the salt. That's where they got the salt.
What was this mill that's up here? Is it a twilling mill, is it called? Or what was this used for up on Shaker-Tigger itself, you know, up on Upper Main Street? You know what I'm talking about? The mill that's up on the water.
That was just chicken feed, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that never come to a real later, did it, Nathan?
Sure. You
know, one time here, the poultry business was awful heavy on it here. It was 100,000 chickens raised on 6 acres of land. This was wonderful poultry raising, a climate, and soil.
One thing we don't want to forget is about that Charles Wilson letter. Did it tell something like that? Because he read the written.
I don't know anything about Charles Wilson's letter, so you need to tell me from the beginning.
All right.
Great. Well, as far back as I can remember, the same land we're speaking about up here, just below Green Run, in Oaks Island, is called Little Molar. Well, up through that section, there was some people who got this land surveyed in some way or another. They owned it. I don't know just how it was done. But anyway, it was called the Ocean Beach Land Improvement Company. I bought about 1,100 acres of it for a while. Maddox, who lived here on the island, but after a while, the Park Service took it over. Well, when I was working for the club, there was a man by the name of John Sanford. Lived in Baltimore. He was a judge. So he got this letter from England. This person over in England had bought this old pub, they call them, I think it was in them days. It was more of a place around the waterfront where they had a beer joint and the sailors would come in for it. They'd have so much money to them. And naturally, the people around through that vicinity made a good living.
Right.
Well, this man had bought one of these old buildings. Well, while searching into it, up in the attic, he found this trunk. And in this trunk was this letter. This letter was from a fellow had wrote to his brother. Wrote to his brother and told him that over in America, the second inlet above Chincoteague Island, above Chincoteague Inlet, on the northeast side, between a couple of those, if I can remember, and some cedar stumps, they had buried so many bars of bullion, so many bars of silver, and it was quite a fortune that we'd be
made.
But they'd never been able to find out where the second inlet was. Well, my father, Judge Stafford, when he got the letter, he sent it to my father. Well, we got him looking around, and we began to talk. We thought it was Green Run of it, because it was an inlet to Green Run. There was another one here at Boulder Beach. It could be right up here on the upper end of Chincoteague Island, because it's too cold out there, isn't it?
That's right, it says north.
Yeah. So, we just don't know why. People have been looking for it for the last 100 years.
You're really going out reasonably.
There it
says,
I've never used it yet.
He was
going to
go out and see what he could do about it. Yeah, I would certainly think so.
Father, he had that letter, but you know how you'll do, you get these things, and it's worthless. First thing, it disappeared. Yeah, like the old spinning wheels. They told you old spinning wheels. I knew it was a lot of money later. So that's the way things happen. And since then, it comes out every once in a while. It's come out in the papers around. But we never could figure out the second inlet of Bush Inca T. But I'm like that. I guess they figured right up here somewhere around 86.
Yeah. But it's, you don't know if it's on Astig or on Chase?
You won't read this.
Think more if it's on Chase. Okay.
North of the second inlet above Chincoteague Island, Virginia, which is at the south end of the peninsula. At the head of the third creek to the northward is a bluff facing the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, with cedar trees growing on it, each about 1 1/3 yards apart. Between the trees, I buried in 10 iron-bound chests bars of silver, gold, diamonds, and jewels to the sum of 20,000 pounds, 200,000 pounds sterling. Go to Woody Knoll secretly and remove the treasure. Signed, Charles Wilson.
a lot lumped up there, and his houses on the old foundation still there. Well, they went around there, and they dig. Well, a long time they found no...